Chapter 30. Essay: Is Life Meaningful Without Children? Verse 1. When Rachel saw that she had borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister. And Rachel said to Jacob, "Give me children, or I shall die." Abraham expressed a similar sentiment to that of Rachel. "What can you give me?" he asked God, "seeing that I die childless." Genesis chapter 15, verse 2. Rachel believed that without children, her life had no purpose, and there was little point in going on. Rachel is hardly alone in this view. Her view has been that of most people, especially, but certainly not only, women, in just about every culture in history. Life without children has been deemed essentially worthless, even tantamount to death. As the Lion Handbook, a reference guide to the Bible, notes, childlessness was always regarded as a calamity. For a typical view outside of the Western world, here is a Hindu echo of Rachel's perspective. Orthodox Hindus do not approve of childlessness and consider it to be very inauspicious. Women without children have to face social discomfort and questioning looks from friends and relations. Newly married couples have to deal with peer pressure if they fail to produce children within a reasonable time after their marriage. Catholicism did honor one category of people who chose not to marry and thereby remain childless: priests, monks, and nuns. But outside these specific vows of celibacy, Christians were expected to marry — marriage is one of the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church — and to have children. Traditional Catholicism forbids Catholics from practicing birth control. And most Christians viewed not having children as much a tragedy as Jews and others have. When one hears of a Christian family with four or more children, it is safe to assume they are religious. Within Jewish life, there has been both agreement and disagreement with Rachel's view. On the one hand, the Talmud notes the commonly held view of childlessness as a form of death, and as the classic 1902 Jewish Encyclopedia noted, to be without children is regarded as the greatest curse. On the other hand, the Bible itself assures the childless that their lives are indeed precious, and that God will profoundly compensate them. "For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant, to them I will give in my house and within my walls a memorial and a name better than that of sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name which will not be cut off." Isaiah chapter 56, verses 4 through 5. Rabbi Isaac Aramah, a 15th-century Spanish rabbi, known by the name of his Torah commentary, Akedat Yitzhak, taught there are two words in Hebrew for woman, which denote two purposes. First, she is called Isha, woman, a being who was taken from man, see Genesis chapter 2, verse 23, and who, like man, can advance in intellectual and moral realms. And second, Chava, Eve, referring to the first woman, and hence the mother of all the living, Genesis chapter 3, verse 20, a being who, unlike man, is able to bear children. A barren woman is nonetheless capable of living as purposeful and fulfilling a life as a man, and therefore should not consider her life worthless if she cannot have children. Her life is every bit as meaningful and worthwhile as that of a childless man. In other words, if a childless man can lead a meaningful life, so can a childless woman. Thus, the Akedat Yitzhak invokes the verses cited from Isaiah, and then adds, "Rachel was no more dead because she was childless than Jacob would have been if he were childless." Of course, a woman who wishes to have children but cannot does not compare herself to childless men, but to women who have children. And that, to be sure, can be painful. It would be dishonest to deny that children can vastly enrich a person's life. It would also be dishonest to deny that children do not necessarily enrich a person's life. many children bring great pain to parents. Nevertheless, the notion if a person does not have a child, he or she is essentially dead, is intellectually, morally, and religiously absurd. It would mean that if we have no children, all the good we do is worthless. All the love we experience is pointless. That nothing short of a child, not even God, let alone a spouse, friends, work, religion, service to others, passions, makes life meaningful. Nahama Leibowitz, one of the greatest Bible teachers of the 20th century, had no children. It is therefore particularly interesting to read her take on Rachel's words, "Give me children or I shall die." Leibowitz is not sympathetic. This was a treasonable repudiation of her function, a flight from her destiny and purpose, shirking the duties imposed on her, not in virtue of her being a woman, but in virtue of her being a human being. All the preceding notwithstanding, having children, biologically or through adoption, should be a high priority in people's lives. The increasing trend in the Western world not to have children is a national death wish. So many men and women in the West and other developed countries are choosing not to have children that some nations' populations are in steep decline. Unless their birth rates are reversed, some nations will ultimately disappear, unless a vast number of people from other nations and cultures are brought in which case those nations will still disappear. They will be replaced by another nation. An undersupply of children also crushes nations' economies because there are too few young people to help support the older generation. On the personal level, choosing not to have children is often a choice not to mature. Nothing matures people like marriage and raising children does. Regarding Rachel's plea, "Give me children or I shall die," Harold Kushner notes the tragic irony that it is while giving birth to her second son that Rachel dies. Genesis chapter 35, verses 16 through 20. What is a man to do when his wife lashes out in pain? Verse 2. Jacob was incensed at Rachel. Traditional Jewish commentators fault Jacob for failing to be more understanding of Rachel's anguish. However, there are at least two possibilities that would exonerate Jacob's anger. First, Rachel's demand implied that her husband was in some way withholding children from her. Second, by declaring that she would rather die than live without children, Rachel was essentially saying her life with her husband was worthless. Obviously, such a dispiriting comment would have deeply hurt Jacob, whose love for Rachel was so great he worked 14 years in order to marry her. An example of a different response comes from American history. The 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, and his wife, coincidentally named Rachel, had no children. As reported in a biography of Jackson, Rachel, according to a family story, cried, "Oh, husband, how I wish I had a child." With grace, Jackson said, "Darling, God knows what to give, what to withhold. Let's not murmur against him." To be fair, the tone of Andrew Jackson's Rachel was more plaintive than accusatory. But the pained comment of Jacob's Rachel is also understandable. Her husband already had children through Leah. It is probably fair to conclude that Rachel knew Jacob was no more at fault than she for her barrenness, and what she wanted from him was compassion. In general, men tend to be more oriented towards finding solutions, and Jacob was undoubtedly frustrated by his helplessness, whereas women want to know that their pain is heard. Verse 2 continued, "And said, Can I take the place of God, who has denied you fruit of the womb?" Jacob recognized everything is ultimately in God's hands. Unfortunately, he chose words that were virtually guaranteed to intensify Rachel's pain, implying that God himself didn't want her to have children. I suspect even years later, after Rachel's premature death, Jacob regretted speaking to her so harshly. One of the cruelest things a believer can say to another believer is their suffering is their own fault and may even be God's will. Verse 3. She said, "Here is my maid Bilhah." Like Sarah, Rachel tried to solve her problem by offering a concubine to her husband. Verse 3 continued, "Consort with her that she may bear on my knees, and that through her I too may have children." In the ancient world, placing the newborn on someone's knees was a gesture of adoption, altar. Verse 4. So she gave him her maid Bilhah as concubine, and Jacob cohabited with her. Verse 5. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. 4 of Jacob's 12 sons were born through concubines. These sons, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, were considered every bit as much tribes of Israel as the sons of Rachel and Leah. The fact that some were born to concubines rather than wives is irrelevant. Verse 6. And Rachel said, "God has vindicated me. Indeed, he has heeded my plea and given me a son." Therefore, she named him Dan. Though she was not the birth mother, Rachel was the one who reared Dan and the other sons born to Bilhah. Therefore, like an adoptive mother today, she was considered their mother. Dan means judged or vindicated. Verse 7. Rachel's maid, Bilhah, conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. It seems that everybody except Rachel is able to conceive a child. To add to the hurt, and in a world that so favored sons, every other wife and concubine of Jacob is bearing him a son, not just a child. Hamilton. Verse 8. And Rachel said, "A fateful contest I waged with my sister. Yes, and I have prevailed." So she named him Naphtali. This is one of the saddest lines in the Torah. It is actually pathetic, an indication of just how insecure Rachel was. She has already said she considered her life worthless without children. But now we see that having a child to nurture and love was not enough. She was in competition with her older sister. Naphtali comes from a Hebrew word meaning to contest. Verse 9. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as concubine. Verse 10. And when Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Verse 11. Leah said, "What luck!" So she named him Gad. Gad appears as the name of the god of fortune and good luck. This pagan divinity is also mentioned in Isaiah chapter 65, verse 11. Sarna. Verse 12. When Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Verse 13. Leah declared, "What fortune," meaning, "Women will deem me fortunate." So she named him Asher. To this day, in modern Hebrew, the word Asher means fortunate or happy. A famous verse in Psalms 84, verse 5. 84 verse 4 in Christian texts begins with this word, Ashre Yoshve Vatecha. Happy are those who dwell in your house. Verse 14. Once, at the time of the wheat harvest, Reuben came upon some mandrakes in the field. According to a common ancient superstition, the mandrake plant had the power to enhance sexual desire and induce pregnancy. Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, was known as the Lady of the Mandrake. Mandrakes were customarily placed under the bridal bed in Germany. And in the Song of Songs, the maiden tells her lover she has stored up fragrant mandrakes for him, chapter 7, verse 14. Furthermore, Dodi, the Hebrew word for my beloved, is similar to Dudaim, the Hebrew word for mandrake. The Torah, however, ascribes no efficacy to these plants, because it prohibits superstition. Superstition, at its essence, is a form of idol worship in that it implies something other than God such as a black cat or a broken mirror, governs the world. Verse 14 continued, and brought them to his mother, Leah. Reuben probably felt bad for his mother because she was the less desired wife. Verse 14 continued, Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Verse 15, but she said to her, was it not enough for you to take away my husband? It has been said that when it comes to self-justification, everyone is a genius. For Leah to accuse Rachel of taking Jacob from her, when precisely the opposite was the case, was an extraordinary act of self-justification. It also manifests another common human trait, portraying oneself as the victim when one is, in fact, the victimizer. Verse 15 continued, that you would also take my son's mandrakes. Clearly, it is not only brothers who do not get along in Genesis. Verse 15 continued, Rachel replied, I promise, he shall lie. As Nahum Sarna explains, the Hebrew word shechav, to lie with or to lay, when used in Genesis to refer to sexual relations, never connotes a relationship of marital love, but is invariably used in unsavory circumstances. Rachel offered Leah one night of sex with their mutual husband, not a night of lovemaking. Verse 15 continued, with you tonight, in return for your son's mandrakes. Leah desired love above all else, but she clearly also desired more children. And despite her children through Bilhah, Rachel was still desperate to become pregnant. So the sisters struck this deal with one another. Verse 16. When Jacob came home from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you are to sleep with me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. The verb used here, lischor, means to hire in modern Hebrew as well. The term is used to refer to renting or hiring, a car, for instance, for a temporary period of time. Leah was so hungry for love, she resorted to hiring her own husband for a night. Despite Leah's role in deceiving Jacob into marrying her, it is difficult not to feel compassion for her lifelong pain at not being loved. She must have believed on some level sleeping with Jacob the first night would induce him to love her. But that proved to be a terrible mistake. We cannot manipulate people into loving us. Perhaps had she not tried to do so, she would have been able to marry a man who did love her, or at least wanted to make love to her. Verse 16 continued, and he lay with her that night. Jacob seems to have readily acquiesced to the women in his life. He did as his mother instructed in deceiving Isaac. He complied with Rachel when she told him to impregnate her maidservant, and he didn't argue when Leah announced she had hired him to sleep with her for the night. Verse 17. God heeded Leah, and she conceived and bore him a fifth son. Though Rachel was the one who ended up with the supposedly pregnancy-inducing mandrakes, she was not the next one to become pregnant. The Torah is making clear that magical formulas are powerless. The world is governed by God. See the language employed in verses 22 through 24. Verse 18, and Leah said, God has given me my reward for having given my maid to my husband. So she named him Issachar. Sahar, in both biblical and modern Hebrew, means reward. Verse 19. When Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Verse 20. Leah said, God has given me a choice gift. This time my husband will exalt me, for I have borne him six sons. One would think that by now Leah would have realized that no number of sons could induce her husband to fall in love with her. It is a fact of life that what evokes romantic love is somewhat mysterious, but whatever it is, it cannot be manipulated or controlled by human action. Sometimes love can be rekindled when it has faded over time and with life's vagaries. But for that to happen, it has to have been there in the first place. Throughout history, people have tried to make others love them, all to no avail. Such efforts guarantee only frustration and heartache, and should be consciously avoided. One of the keys to happiness is to accept reality. In this regard, the beginning of the Serenity Prayer, authored by the American Christian theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, 1892-1971, and used worldwide in 12-step programs for addicts, is applicable to this and so many other aspects of life. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Verse 20, continued. So she named him Zebulun. Verse 21, last she bore him a daughter and named her Dinah. After the birth of each of the sons, the Torah recounted the mother's explanation of her choice of name for that child. Only the daughter's name is not explained. This is a good example of how one's attitude affects how one approaches Torah narrative. Does the lack of elaboration on Dinah's name reflect on the Torah as sexist? Or is the Torah simply describing the sexist reality that existed in the ancient world, where the birth of a daughter was deemed worthy of only a brief mention? The strong and even heroic roles played by women in the Torah, from the matriarchs to the daughter of Pharaoh to the midwives who disobeyed Pharaoh, argue strongly for the latter explanation. Verse 22. Now God remembered Rachel. God heeded her and opened her womb. When the Torah describes God as remembering, it does not mean God had previously forgotten. It means God has decided to act, often from a human perspective, at long last. The Torah explicitly states it was God who opened Rachel's womb, lest there be any suspicion that the mandrakes were responsible. Verse 23, she conceived and bore a son, and said, God has taken away my disgrace. Verse 24, so she named him Joseph, which is to say, may the Lord add another son for me. The Hebrew word for Joseph, Yosef, means he will add, reflecting Rachel's desire for an additional son. She has just given birth to a son, and she names him, may the Lord add another son. Two reasons suggest themselves. She is in competition with her sister, and until the modern period, many children died at a very young age. Verse 25. After Rachel had borne Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, give me leave to go back to my own homeland. Verse 26. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served you, that I may go, for well you know what services I have rendered you. In keeping with laws of the ancient world, Jacob spoke here as if he had the status of an indentured servant, almost a slave, in which case his wives and children would not automatically belong to him. See Exodus chapter 21, verses 2 through 4. But he was not a slave, nor was he an indentured servant. Why, then, did he seek permission to take them with him before leaving? Laban was his uncle, not his master. He had no claim of ownership on his wives or their children. The reason Jacob had agreed to work 14 years for his two wives was that he brought no money or property into the marriage. All that work for Laban was essentially a bride price, which he had long since paid. He had every right to leave with his family, but he apparently wanted to do so without burning bridges with his uncle and father-in-law. He wanted to go and to take Laban's daughters and grandchildren with Laban's blessing. Verse 27. But Laban said to him, if you will indulge me, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me on your account. Laban acknowledged God was responsible for his having prospered, and the benefits he received were due entirely to Jacob's relationship with God. Verse 28, and he continued, "Name the wages due from me, and I will pay you." Verse 29, but he said, "You know well how I have served you, and how your livestock has fared with me." Verse 30, "For the little you had before I came has grown to much, since the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. And now when shall I make provision for my own household?" Verse 31, he said, "What shall I pay you?" And Jacob said, "Pay me nothing." Jacob didn't want monetary wages. He wanted to be paid in the one commodity he knew how to manage and multiply. Verse 31 continued, "If you will do this thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flocks." Verse 32, "Let me pass through your whole flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted animal, every dark-colored sheep, and every spotted and speckled goat. Such shall be my wages." These animals were rare, meaning verse 34, and Laban said, "Very well, let it be as you say." Verse 35, "But that same day he removed the streaked and spotted he-goats and all the speckled and spotted she-goats, every one that had white on it, and all the dark-colored sheep, and left them in the charge of his sons." Verse 36, "And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Laban's flock." Verse 37, "Jacob then got fresh shoots of poplar and of almond and plane, and peeled white stripes in them, laying bare the white of the shoots." Verse 38, "The rods that he had peeled he set up in front of the goats in the troughs, the water receptacles, that the goats came to drink from. Their mating occurred when they came to drink." Verse 39, "And since the goats mated by the rods, the goats brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted young." In the ancient world, it was believed the color of the rods by which farm animals mated would determine the color of their progeny. Although it is surprising to us today that the Torah devotes so many verses to flocks and rods, the extent of the detail is further evidence of the antiquity of the Torah. It was obviously written at a time when these beliefs governed animal husbandry practices. Verse 40, "But Jacob dealt separately with the sheep. He made these animals face the streaked or wholly dark-colored animals in Laban's flock. And so he produced special flocks for himself, which he did not put with Laban's flocks." Verse 41, "Moreover, when the sturdier animals were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the troughs, in full view of the animals, so that they mated by the rods." Verse 42, "But with the feebler animals, he would not place them there. Thus the feeble ones went to Laban, and the sturdy to Jacob." Verse 43, "So the man grew exceedingly prosperous, and came to own large flocks, maidservants and menservants, camels, and asses."